BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to the 30th of May edition of Dialect. Greetings to you all, be you in Bristol, Preston or even South America. And this week we have Reinaldo Marequeo, General Secretary of the Mapuche International Link, live in the studio. He's here to discuss the Mapuche Indians of South America and we'll hear some of their music. We'll also be hearing the music of the Aborigines and hearing about them thanks to Anthea Page. Josie Hill of the 125 Project that helps Bristol women who are sex workers discusses winning a recent national award. And we hear author Peter Lavender discuss the Nazis. Jeff Sparks, sadly, is off sick, but John Peters Coleman will be replacing him to do the What's On Guide. We revisit the Hillsborough Project 20 years on. And last, but definitely not least, Malcolm Greaves reads another episode of The Diary of an Innkeeper by John Fothergill. What a packed show. But we start with Reinaldo Marequeo. Welcome to the studio, Reinaldo.
Hello.
First of all, you represent the, some Mapuche Indians. What exactly do you do?
Well, we campaign for human rights for the Mapuche, the indigenous people of southern part of Chile and Argentina. And I've been campaigning since 1978 when we, the Mapuche, have the first General Assembly in London, and we organize ourselves as a committee of Mapuche in exile. Most of the Mapuche were arrived to Europe, a few in England, because of the military coup in Chile in 1973.
Okay, so can you just tell you what part of South America they're from? You say in between Argentina and Chile. So am I right in thinking that the Mapuche are one of these people who are stateless? So they're the on the one hand they've got the on sort of on the west side they've got the Chilean government and the on the east side the Argentinian government and the Mapuche are sort of sandwiched in the middle.
Well, we used to live. In what is known as the Southern Cone, which is all the south of what is today Chile and Argentina, including the Patagonia and the Araucanía, is the Chilean part. And we were one of the few indigenous nations that the Spanish never defeated. So after 100 years of war, they decided to recognize our independence in a treaty called the Treaty of Quijín in 1641. And the border was established. And since then, the Spanish, they tried for many times to advance to the south and annex the Mapuche land to their region that they used to control. And this, but they couldn't. They continuously were defeated. And so in the end, there were about 28 treaties in which the Spanish they recognized the initial border established in 1641. So when Chile and Argentina became independent, that is the north part, what is today Chile and Buenos Aires and Santiago, became independent of Spain. After 50 years of their independence, they initiate military campaign to in order to annex the Mapuche land to their respective country. And, of course, the Mapuche resist. And this campaign, military campaign, and the Mapuche were defeated in 1885. And since 1985 until today, the Mapuche, they are struggling for their survival.
So, I mean, it sounds like a battle over land, but it's also, you know, a battle about identity, isn't it? And the Mapuche making sure that they can keep their own indigenous culture.
Yes, because the Mapuche were a nation like any other nation. We have our own national identity. We were nations and they were fight for a long, long period of time against the Inca Empire. So the war that the Mapuche have defending their territory is back before the Spanish arrival to the Americas.
So how are the Mapuche Indians today, and whereabouts are they?
Well, the Mapuche still they live in different communities in the southern part of Chile, in different areas. Their land has been taken gradually more and more, and they are confined to live in a terrible situation of misery because the land and resources has been taken from them. And today, even in democracy, the Mapuche, they suffer human rights atrocities. The current government of Chile, who is a socialist government, Michelle Bachelet, they are applying the anti-terrorist law, who was a law that was introduced during the Pinochet regime. It was designed to against the democratic fight, the people that fight for democracy in Chile. So it was this law today, they apply solely to the only to the Mapuche.
So can you just tell us about how this is affecting the Mapuche? How and why is it, do you think, that they are treating the Mapuche Indians as terrorists?
Because I suppose where the Chile and Argentina, they feel that the national unity of the country, they see us as a threat because we have this long history of a people that they never surrender to their right, you know, as a people. And the Mapuche, they play all the different, even they organize themselves as a kingdom to be accepted and recognized by the European nation in 1860. The idea was to then the leader, the Mapuche leader, the chief, they thought if they organized in a Western type of social organization or government, they will be accepted as a nation within the free nation of the time. And all this history is very much in the mind of ordinary Mapuche.
Now, are there groups around the world that are actually supporting the Mapuche? I mean, it's all very well to hear about the Argentinian and the Chilean government making life very difficult, but is there support out there in other parts of the world?
Yes, there are. There are, because the Mapuche, we are quite active at the United Nations, the Human Rights Council, the various committees of the Human Rights, dealing with human rights, all the main human rights organizations, such as Amnesty International, and the International Federation of Human Rights, Human Rights Watch, all these very well-known and respected human rights organizations, they sent to the Mapuche territory a fact-finding mission to find out about this denounced situation that the Mapuche have been doing throughout the many centuries, and particularly lately with the introduction of the internet.
So how many Mapuche people are there, and how many were there originally?
We believe that we were about 2 million people when the arrival of the Spanish, and today we might we don't know exactly how many we are, but there are estimation done by the Mapuche themselves, and we think that we are about 1.5 million in Chile, although the Chilean official version is that we are about 1 million, and in Argentina about 300,000 people.
Okay, we're going to hear some Mapuche music now. So no matter how much the Chileans and Argentinians try and assimilate the Mapuche, they have definitely got their own identity, haven't they? So we'll have a listen to some music now, and then we can talk a bit more about Mapuche culture.
Definitely. That music request of the of a group from Chile, a contemporary group, and is what the Mapuche today play.
Okay, can you tell us a bit more about the culture? What other things identify the Mapuche Indians from the sort of official Spanish descent colonial groups in Argentina and Chile?
Well, we have our own language. The language is called Maputugun, which means the language of the land. Mapu is meaning land, and Dugun is language. We have our own religious belief. We have our shaman called Machis. They are the spiritual leader of our people. We have chief still in our communities, are respected by the Mapuche as their authority, and we have music, and we have our own sport. It's called palín, which is similar to the hockey, and it's a type of ancient game that the Mapuche used to play in the past and still do.
Okay, so finally, what future do you see for the Mapuche?
I think because it's the Chilean and Argentinian, they cannot exterminate them as they tried in the past by genocide. The Mapuche, they are going to be stronger and stronger. They will, it's a nation that will survive.
Well, let's hope so. And have you got a website?
Yes, we have a website. It's mapuche-nation.org.
Okay, and if you're searching for it, look for Mapuche Nation, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, Ronaldo, we've got our next item coming up, but before we start, you actually do know a little bit about this. We have an interview just coming out with a guy called Peter Lavender, who's written a book called Unholy Alliance, and this is an investigation into this 20th, if not 21st century version of the Nazis, because a lot of Nazis came from Germany after the Second World War, didn't they, to South America. Yeah. And we start this piece. Peter Lavender is actually at this place called Colonia
Dignidad.
Right. So how has that featured? Because I know some Mapuche people were taken there.
Yes, well, we hear that refugees, when we came from Chile during the Pinochet era, that many Chilean they were taken there and was they were interrogated and tortured in that particular place.
It's a kind of city, or a little town or a fortress up in the mountains in between Chile and Argentina.
Yes, they have it's like an autonomous region for immigrant from Germany, and it's a very secretive area because people they don't go there. They are not allowed to go there, and there are a lot control. And because they are powerful, they have a lot. They have the media. They have the powerful people in the authorities and lawyers, and so it's very difficult to. For ordinary people to go and check what they are doing.
I remember Peter, in his book Unholy Alliance, when I read it, he was saying that he couldn't even persuade a taxi driver for three times the fare to take him there.
No, because it's simply not, it's not done.
It's a no-go area, as you might expect for a sort of modern Nazi cult. Anyway, thanks for that. And we're now going to hear Peter Lavender. He's just got a new book out called Sinister Forces, but here he talks about what happened to him after he was told he mustn't investigate Colonia Dignidad and he was sent away by the Nazis.
I was told by the Germans that I was not welcome in the country, that I had to leave Chile immediately. And as I was allowed to leave, which was touch and go for a while, all the way back to Santiago, to the capital where I had my hotel room, I was stopped along the way. I was in a bus and I was stopped along the way by troops who had set up roadblocks, who were making sure that I was on that bus. And when I got back to my hotel room, there was a note waiting for me that said I was on the next plane, that a reservation had been made. So the amount of influence that a Nazi network had in 1979 was so many years after the end of World War II. You know, we're talking 25 years later. They still had such great influence in a country so far away as Chile, that I began to see there was a lot more going on than even I suspected, and that eventually became Unholy Alliance. I began to see the connections between governments in Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, an extensive Nazi network, a lot of money that had left the Third Reich when the Nazis had lost the war, and I began to realize that the Nazi Party was not a political party the way we understand political parties, but that the Nazi Party was a cult. And if you look at it from that point of view, you can understand the true nature of this kind of evil, because the Nazi Party is, they're not going to go away simply because they lost the war. The old war criminals who escaped, and some of them are still alive, a few of them have died recently in South America, in Chile and in Argentina. They have their followers, they have their philosophy, their ideology. Depends on which regime is in power at any given time. But let's take the example of Bolivia. Klaus Barbie, who was the butcher of Lyon in France, who was a man responsible for all sorts of war crimes in France, at one point became the chief of the secret police of Bolivia. I mean, he had a federally appointed position in that government. Walter Rauf lived for a very long time in Chile. Walter Rauf was the man who designed the mobile gas chambers, the vans that were used to rechannel the exhaust into the vans to kill prisoners. I mean, all of these people found safe haven, not only in South America, but in the Middle East and in Asia as well, to a certain extent in Australia. Of course, we've had many cases here in the United States of war criminals that we found uncovered and occasionally shipped back. I mean, a famous one, which got me very involved in the story, was the man who for a long time was the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church in the United States. Here was an archbishop who, during World War II, had been a member of the Iron Cross, or the Iron Arrow, I think, a Romanian Nazi organization who had tortured prisoners. Here was a man who was a devoted Nazi who, after the war was over, fled to the United States. And although he had no seminarial training, as far as I've been able to uncover, he managed to take over one branch of the Romanian Orthodox Church in our country, in the Midwest, and was not even discovered until maybe 20 years ago, when he was forced to leave the country. So, yeah, we've helped a lot of people escape. The Catholic Church also, to a certain extent, was involved in that, an operation called Caritas during World War II, which provided Vatican passports to help some of the more famous war criminals escaped to South America. So there was a lot of collaboration. And even in our own country, in the United States, we had Operation Paperclip, in which we brought Nazi scientists over to help with our space program, among other things. So that got me working on what eventually became Sinister Forces. I began to wonder, how was it that we in the United States could have sold our souls so easily to something as heinous as a criminal organization like the SS and to the Nazis in general, to bring their scientists over here to make them work for us and really to give them great jobs, to give them positions in our industry. Walter Dornberger is an example, who held a job on the board of directors of Bell Helicopter. All sorts of people who worked for the space medicine program in Texas at Randolph Air Force Base. There's a very big story there. I develop the same ideas in book two. I focus a lot on the Charles Manson family as a kind of quintessential example of what sinister forces might be, from the behavior modification, mind control aspect. And then in book three, I sort of lay out what I think is the whole story and how this works. I connect serial killers to mind control operations and try to understand. I mean, our country, the CIA in particular, in the 1950s, 1960s, all the way up through until about Watergate, until the 1970s and the Rockefeller investigations, was involved in one of the most bizarre experiments of modern times. I mean, here we were trying to figure out how the human consciousness worked, how to understand memory, volition, how do we erase a person's memory, implant new memories, how do we make a person do something they would not ordinarily do, for instance, commit an assassination, and then forget about it and not know why they did it. I mean, this was something like a medieval king, you might think, is hiring alchemists and magicians, you know, to contact the other world. We were doing that in the 1950s and 60s, and probably still are today. We have operations in which we're trying to understand how the mind works, and then to control it, like a sorcerer's apprentice. Our intelligence agencies stuck their fingers into human consciousness and started playing around with the contents.
And that was Peter Lavender there, speaking about his new book, Sinister Forces, and his old book from the 1990s, Unholy Annoyance. And it was explaining what happened to him when he went to research a Nazi-controlled fortress on the Argentina-Chile border back in 1979.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Josie Hill works as a fundraiser for the 125 charity, which supports vulnerable women, sex workers on the streets of Bristol. The charity recently has won the Integrated Health Award, the sum of £5,000, which is organised by the Prince's Foundation for Integrated Health and is sponsored by the Department of Health. Josie's here to tell us about the forthcoming night walk on the 13th of June, organised by the 125 charity.
Josie Hill has come straight from an awards ceremony in London. Eagle-eared listeners will have spotted that we have interviewed her before. The 125, or the 125 charity, which supports vulnerable women, sex workers on the streets of Bristol, has won the Integrated Health Award, a sum of £5,000, which is organised by the Prince's Foundation for Integrated Health and is sponsored by the Department of Health. Josie's here in the studio to tell us about the forthcoming night walk. And that's happening on the 13th of June, organised by the 125 charity. Hello, Josie. Congratulations.
Hello. Thank you very much. I hope I talk properly today, because I'm a bit tired from talking so quickly to people like Roger Daltrey from The Who today.
Name-dropping. Nice.
Name-dropping all over the place, and Prince Charles himself.
Okay, who was more exciting to me?
I couldn't possibly say on radio. I listen to more of The Who's music than Prince Charles's music, but
okay.
Then I'm a big fan of his Elderflower Cordial, so, you know, it's up to you to decide.
And his very expensive biscuits.
It's very expensive biscuits when I give them at Christmas.
Okay.
I've come straight from there. We're massively delighted to win the England Awards, because it's just such great recognition of the work we do. As you say, we're supporting around 200 women in Bristol who are desperate to break free from their life of sex work and drug addiction and homelessness on the street. Mm-hmm. And part of that is trying to raise funds to keep us going, and so we launched something called the Night Walk last year. It was very exciting. It was the first one of its kind in Bristol, and we managed to raise over £7,000 in sponsorship money. So this June the 13th, which is a Saturday night, we're doing it again. We're asking people to sign up for it and turn up on the night, hopefully with some raised sponsorship money, but no minimum, and either do the 5 mile walk or the full 10 mile challenge, which is a figure of eight around Bristol's most iconic sites.
Okay.
I should also mention that this year there's a summertime theme, so we're inviting people to dress up in however they decide the summertime theme should be interpreted. We've got people from local drugs agencies, they've said they might be coming as Grease characters.
Nice.
We've got other people coming bizarrely as Famous Five characters, and all sorts of funny things. So that'll be a sight to see for Bristolians who might be out at between 8 p.m. and 1 a.m. on the Saturday the 13th.
Okay, brilliant. So you won the award for England. How many other sort of charities were you sort of competing against? How big a deal is this?
Well, we were told that they shortlisted it to over 100 strong entrants. They didn't mention how many feeble entries there were, actually, and I didn't want to ask. But no, it was very exciting. There were some great ones in there. There was Sarah Lee Trust, Age Concern, some really good names. So we were absolutely delighted to have won it.
Okay, what are you going to do? Do you think with £5,000 is probably a lifesaver, really, for the amount of money to have?
It's funny you say lifesaver, because one of our the first points, the first services we give out to the women is our outreach van. That's been running for about 13 years now,
right,
and has been described by the women as a lifesaver and a turning point in their life. It goes out 5 nights a week and provides them with food, condoms, healthcare, all sorts of things. And actually our trusty yellow van broke down a couple of months ago and did not pass its MOT, so probably be putting the money towards keeping that going.
Okay, brilliant.
Getting a new van and sending it out there again.
Okay, so start your imaginations going. There's a night walk on the 13th of June. Where are you sort of meeting? Where is the starting point for
it? The meeting point is at the Arc, which is on Cotton Road South in Kingstown. There's directions and all that on our website, which is on www.125.org.uk. 125 is spelled O-N-E, the number 2, number 5. You can also go onto our registration site at Just Giving, which is www.justgiving.com/125nightwalk, and you can sign up there. It's £5 and you will send out registration pack and get lots of free delicious refreshments on the night.
Bargain. Brilliant. Thank you very much, Josie Hill, and congratulations once again.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with Anne Campbell from Melbourne, and it's about the ongoing problem of the plight of the Aboriginals in Australia.
I'm from Australia. I actually grew up on the edge of the Nullarbor Plain, on the edge of the desert, which is midway between Western Australia and South Australia. And my father's role there in his profession was regional oil manager. Australia didn't have any oil at that time, and we had petrol restrictions till about 1953. And his job was to ascertain the needs of the farmers over there. And it must have been a very tough job because it's very high temperature.
What did the farmers need the oil for? Was it for the road trains?
Well, it was for the tractors as well as for the for taking the animals to the markets. And so they had priority over the oil or petrol rather than the private person. And in those days, there was no competition for oil. The country was divided up between Shell Oil Company and Mobil Oil Company. And he was the Mobil Oil representative for a vast area from South Australia to over the Western Australian border.
Do you know how many square miles?
Many, no, I don't, but it's many, many, many square miles, days travelling. And it wasn't bituminised roads, it was sand dunes. And I can remember in the back of the car, he had a big mat and a spade because he had to frequently dig himself out. And when you think about it, there was no air conditioning, there was no radio, there was nothing. And so I used to think he liked taking me with him for company. And it wasn't until just recently that my brother, who's 8 years older, told me it was because I stressed my mother too much and he took me there. But when he...
How old were you at this point?
I was about 4. I hadn't started school. And so he took me, but when he had to do business, he dropped me off at various places. One was a fishing village, and another one was a farm, and another one was a place called Canibba Mission Station, which was run by the Methodists for Aborigines. And it wasn't until years later that I realised it was one of these mission stations where they took children, half-caste children, away from Aboriginal parents.
Are we talking about rabbit-proof fences?
Yes, very similar. And in Australia, the same story in this, the present film, the current film called Australia, they tried to break the habits of the Aboriginal people and take away their culture, and they thought they could do it with taking away the children.
Can you tell us about the contact you had with the Aboriginal people at that point?
Well, there were settlements even in those days, but they were dry settlements, and if the Aborigines had alcohol, they were banned from those settlements. And for instance, there was a Aboriginal who was living in our town called Annie Wombat, and she lived in a cave on the foreshore of the sea, and she taught the children, including me, how to fish and how to catch crabs off the jetty. And that was my first contact with Aboriginals. But my father was also a lay preacher there, and he did a lot of evangelical work, I suppose you'd like to call it. And he had an account out of our own funds where he would provide food, basic food like flour and sugar for the Aborigines at a local grocer's shop, and he would pay. And then periodically, as a reciprocal favour, they would drop kangaroos, dead kangaroos, at our doorstep. So my mother was forced to skin them, and I can remember her cooking the tails of the kangaroos.
You need a big pot.
Mm-hmm. You need to be very strong to chop it up because it's very sinewy.
What religion did the Aborigines believe in?
It was based on stories passed down about mythical beings and how, and it was an explanation of how things were, and it was passed down from mouth to mouth. They never had a written language, and they tend to be nomadic. They didn't build houses, and they just roamed. Once they felt that the area was denatured, they moved on rather than destroy it, which of course the Western people didn't follow. They just simply farmed it till it was so destroyed.
But they're not nomadic now, are they?
They're not nomadic now, but they tend to have a little bit of nomadic streak. They do go off on what they call walkabout, and they don't like closed places, not at all. They get very claustrophobic if they're in a confined space. And they have an interesting concept in that a blink of an eyelid, they can be reincarnated. And so death means nothing to them. And they do get into trouble with the white man's law, and often end up in prison.
Do they have a problem with alcohol?
They do have a problem with alcohol. It would appear that they don't have the gene to utilise the alcohol, all the sugar they consume. So A, they have a very high degree of diabetes, and B, they become alcoholic quite quickly, and that is a problem, because even on their settlements where they are there, a lot of the elders who run the settlements, if they don't make it a dry place, they bring in alcohol and then just become alcoholic quite quickly.
At what sort of age are we talking about? Early age?
Early age. And the children often don't have as much, any hope of jobs and education because it's not encouraged by the elders as much as the white people. And they often indulge in petrol sniffing.
Is that because it's easier?
Well, I think it's because they're so bored and it gives them that thrill as much as some other drugs do, and that's the only drug, if you like to call it, that they have access to.
So what's the Australian government doing about the Aborigines?
The present government has been doing a lot because it's the first government that's ever said, I'm sorry, to the Aborigines. In the past, we've ignored them. We've given them a lot of government handouts in terms of money and hope that that will be rectify the situation. It doesn't, because their culture has been destroyed. They haven't had the opportunities and education that white people have, and nor do they value it as much as white people, I might add. So it's a bit of wrong on both sides. And so they have... It's been a very difficult transition to come into our world. It hasn't worked by governments so far.
How many Aborigines are there?
Well, the true Aboriginal population is very, very small, but the Aborigines believe, and even if they have a tenth of a percent of blood in Aboriginal blood, they are Aboriginals.
And how many half-castes are there? Are there many?
The majority of the Aborigines aren't pure Aboriginals, very few of them.
So does that take them away from their roots slightly?
No, it doesn't. Not in the slightest, because they...
They're stronger Aboriginals, do you mean, than white?
Yes. They believe in any Aboriginal comes to their place, their house or wherever they're living, they cannot refuse to accommodate them. So, you know, in the past, the government has given them accommodation for, say, four people, and in the end, 40 people stay there.
Which causes problems.
Which cause a lot of problems because, as I say, with alcohol being rife, or the consumption of alcohol being quite rife, it's bound to cause problems. It doesn't matter what sort of nationality is there, with 40 people in an enclosed small house. And of course, the neighbours don't like them.
Are they interdispersed with the white people in the towns, or are they in settlements?
Both. There are a lot of settlements, and you have to get permission to go onto those settlements, but there are pockets of Aborigines dotted around. For instance, a number of Aborigines in a town in Sydney, outside Sydney, called Redfern, and a few years ago there's been enormous riots because the police... they say, accidentally killed a small boy. And the police, it would appear, fabricated a lot of the evidence after of what actually happened. And the boy was on a bike and he was knocked and he fell against a fence and died. And it was the police car that hit the boy, which was unfortunate, and they had enormous riots. It was the thing that set the riots off, but it would have probably happened for a number of reasons later.
Is there any one part of Australia where there's more Aborigines than anywhere else?
I would imagine Northern Territory. And they haven't been pushed out like they have in the big cities. But we have, and even in Melbourne, where I live at the moment, they have there are pockets of Aboriginals living.
So do you think they're exploited because of their art?
In the past, yes, but now...
With the change of government.
Once a change of government, but it's also a change of social conscience more than anything, and we are trying to strive to recognise their art potential. And there are galleries in most major capital cities where their work is shown and they get a fair price. Now, how much they get and how much the gallery keeps, I have no idea. But they should get quite a lot because they're quite expensive, their paintings.
And also they're very popular with the tourists.
And they're extremely popular with the tourists. And as well with the didgeridoo, that's one of the number one exporters, I think, with their musical instrument.
So why can't they have their own galleries? Why doesn't the government give them independence, as it were, from... Why are they showing their work in...
don't have any... neither knowledge, but any interest... in running business, commercialisation. They're not interested in that. They never have been, because they still come from this no house, no wealth, no consumerism type society, and they don't value money like we do. Their only value in money is perhaps to indulge in alcohol. But I'd like to say that in comparison to New Zealand, where the Maoris were warlike, the Aborigines were much more peaceful. That's why I think where they lost their sense of direction, because they were just tramped over. And if they did attack the whites, because they did do that, I acknowledge that, the whites retaliated 10 times over. And we've got a very sad and sorry history of really genocide of what we did, particularly in Tasmania, where we rounded them up and just shot them. And, you know, this even today, with it's only been since 1973 where we stopped taking children away from their parents. And many of the stations where the children were looked after, they were mission stations, and they did it because they believed that they were doing the best for the children, the missionaries, trying to give them some sort of education and trying to give them some sort of good food, good Western clothes.
Is there any hope in the future for the Aborigines?
I think
not?
It's going to be a long, long road, and I think that we have to encourage the elders to start taking responsibility. A lot of this starts, a lot of the problems start from their lack of self-worth. They haven't got their culture, they haven't got any meaning to their lives.
And that's because they've been subjugated?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So it's going to be a long, long process. And it's not, the saying sorry was the start of it, but it's by no means the end, and the end will come many, 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 many years away. But I hope they have started in the right direction, and they're really sincere with helping them.
That was Anthea Page talking to Anne Campbell about the Aboriginals. You can hear part two in next week's show.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Now, Jeff Sparks, I'm afraid, is not with us this week for his What's On Guide. He's sick. That's in the medical sense, not the hip-hop sense. And so, as a shadow of Jeff, I'm afraid it won't be quite as good, John. But John Peters Coleman has done his own What's On. And get well soon, Jeff.
Well, shadow indeed, yeah. I'm all dressed in black. I'm going for the Johnny Cashler today because I came straight from work. What's on guide for this week? This is leading up to Saturday and Sunday, the 6th and 7th of June. This is what's going on. On Tuesday the 2nd, there's a night of punk and hardcore at the Junction. And this is particularly noteworthy because the Junction are now closing. Bob Mitchell was finally given up. He sold everything he owns trying to pay all the tax bills and can't be bothered anymore. So the Junction is closing. How historic. Rent-A-Kill are playing their Austrian Stalwarts. They're a punk band alongside up-and-coming Cornwall Punks Bangers. There's a Welsh hardcore crew called A New Day and local boys, Guantanamo Babes. Let's go down there and give it the help it deserves, and that's on Tuesday night.
Where is the Junction, John?
The Junction is on a junction, funnily enough, on Stokes Croft. It's right opposite a whacking great big church, but Stokes Croft's right in the middle of town.
It's on the left-hand side as you're going up Stokes Croft, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, they usually, it's not a very friendly-looking place, I must admit. It's very black, with blacked-out windows, and it looks like it's shut, which is probably why it's going out of business.
Sounds like your kind of place.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It changed a lot since they introduced the smoking laws. It kind of smells a lot of kind of the toilets, basically. It used to smell of smoke, so it was all right, but yeah, that might be why people aren't turning up anymore.
So this is your last chance to sample that wonderful smell.
I'm really selling it. No, it is a nice place, though. The bands are great. If you are short of money in this recession, how terrible, there is a free night at Start the Bus on Thursday the 4th. An experiment on a bird in the Air Pump, which is the name of the band, and the name of the other band that's playing are Not Cool. You can check them out on MySpace, myspace.com/ An Experiment on a Bird in the Air Pump, which is named after a painting in the National Gallery with Not Cool, myspace.com/notcoolisaband. Catapult DJs finished the night playing art, rock, cutting edge, indie, new wave and post-punk. At the Bristol Academy on Thursday the 4th also, the amazing De La Soul, plus support from Central Spills, featuring C Strike, Z Coast, Mackie Skills, Redskin, Sam, Interface, Shads and Super Risk. I'm saying all that like I know who they are, I haven't got a living clue. And the Shoestring DJs, but De La Soul, amazing. I couldn't get the price for that, but I'm imagining it'll be a little bit pricey, seeing as they are legends. All ages can attend, under 14s to be accompanied by an adult. I'll pause at that point. I've got track of the week. I thought, oh, this is just a classic. It leapt straight to mind. And this is Otis Redding with A Change Is Gonna Come. That was Otis Redding with A Change Is Gonna Come. I think the last time I heard that play was when John Peel played it in Nottingham live at a gig, and just stood behind the DJ booth in floods of tears listening to it. A very sentimental man. At the Lab, the new club which used to be the Arc Bar on Broad Street on Saturday the 6th, Fatty Boombastic. If you like to go out and swig a few lagers and jump up and down, this will be your thing. Swinging Four Police funk and soul outfit, introducing enough flavour to burst your tongue. Well, that's what they claim. Those are not my words. Fusing Bath's popular funk quartet with some of Bristol's unsung DJ heroes of breaks, house, hip-hop, dubstep, jungle and more. Saturday night mashup party at Lab. And that's Fatty Boombastic. Those of you who listened in the olden days, a couple of years ago, we used to do this show at the Trinity Centre. around the area of Lawrence Hill. On Sunday the 7th of June, there is a night of audio-visual entertainment to promote the opening of their new community studio. They've been at work at this for many years, so best of luck to them. Room 1, live drum and bass PA, with lots of DJs, a couple XGs, Calm, Subplate, Abomination and DJ Irritant, if that means anything to you. And more horrendous racket in room 2 with Filthy H, Kerry K, Sonic and Jay Fury.
So is that our old studio, John?
I think it is on the first floor. It's not in our old studio. The
one maybe just outside
the one that got damp and people came in and broke our microphones. No, well, they did. It's true. I mean, no, they have put a lot of effort, and the Trinity Centre is really coming on as a community centre. I'm really pleased with them. And that's from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m, and that's £5.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
It's time now for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. If you remember from last week, 1922, out of the need to earn a living, John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Navy Volunteer Pub in Bristol. If you'd like to play with them, they meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session, so you can just turn up and join them.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The Hypocrites Club. Unfortunately, I made no notes about this amazing party at the time, though I believe notes upon its doings were collated by one of the party. It was the funeral bake meets of the Just Suppressed Brother Proctor's Club. Being ill-equipped at the time for so big a party as 50, I was too busy and exhausted to remember much about it, and I knew very few of them personally. I have a clear image of David Plunkett Green, 6'9" high, dressed in white flannel trousers and a thin white vest, and Lord Elmley had a purple dress suit. And as he was by way of coming of age, he supplied the 60 bottles of champagne which I set out, 9 inches apart, down the middle of their table, 40 feet long, that ran close against the wall of the dance room, the rest of which was clear for dancing. And Turville Petrie, who later went to the East to excavate anthropologically and discovered with his umbrella the oldest known skull within a day or two of his arrival. Rudolf Messel, even better looking than Turville Petrie, and quite the vainest, or rather the only vain one of the lot. The Greenidge brothers, pleasantly quite mad. Robert Byron, shrouded in lace trimmings, slept blissfully on a sofa after dinner, previsioning Byzantine art, upon which, 2 years afterwards, he was considered an authority. Two of them squatted in the hearse outside and smoked. The flesh cart, the coachman used to call it, when he and the gardener took it out for me at £3 3s a time, until I sold it for £1. Harold Acton made the great speech with his big Ben-like voice, "Gentlemen! Dear gentlemen, I wish to propose the toast." A speech full of incredible precocity and rare quotation that would have surprised Aubrey Beardsley. The dancing was terrific. I have an image of wild goats and animals leaping in the air. It must have been a record party in Oxford history. Feebly, efforts were made to carry on the good work, but Harold, who was a real person, had gone down. And it finished, pro tem. I was not sorry, because the subsequent aesthetes were mainly silly and they came here. I'm grateful to the Hypocrite set. Whatever their indiscretions and unpopularity in Oxford, they did like good furniture and a beautiful room, good food and wine, and they practised conversation. In fact, they liked all that this place stands for, and through their coming here frequently at our beginnings, they helped, unwittingly perhaps, to keep away the bounder, and to give us a name for discriminating and saner people. A neat little commercial man came into the hall, followed by his wife, followed by their boy. Can I book rooms here provisionally?
Oh, yes.
But, he would insist, provisionally.
Ah, yes, I said. You mean with provisions? This may seem invented in Aberdeen. 6 days ago, a Scotsman arrived and booked a room for a week. Before he got through the second door into the hall, he made excited inquiries about what whisky I kept and ordered a bottle to be sent up at once. Now, at least for some spirit trade, I thought. And ever since then, I have sold him nothing but siphons. On a very cold day, when no one came to lunch, I found a female sitting by a wonderful fire, spreading out carefully sandwiches, bread, butter, cakes, wine, and a glass on the table. I told her that the room cost something in upkeep, which justified a charge or at least a request for the use of it, whereas if she went into a field the farmer wouldn't object because he doesn't light a fire in it, nor sweep the grass, nor polish the trees, and so she said she'd go if I wished, and I said I wouldn't mind if she did. A year before that, when still almost no one ever came to lunch, though we always had big joints frizzling in the oven ready for the imaginary people, a girl I'd once known quite well came in and asked if they could lunch here, and I thought delightedly of the joint of pork frizzling in the oven, and of my usefulness to the public. I told her I'd be delighted for them to lunch. "Where can we sit?" she asked. "Anywhere you like," and she chose a table. "Our luncheon is in the car," she said, and going out she returned with sandwiches, bread and butter, her husband, cake, a literary friend, glasses and wine, and they sat down together. Rather resenting this unexcused buffoonery, I made nasty remarks en passant, e.g., Augustus John and Aurelia were here last weekend, and they brought their beds. No one smiled. And afterwards they asked for a glass of sherry all round for the good of the house. I did my best to dissuade them, but they won. It's all right and that, but it was not businesslike of them or me. A dining club. I had a letter from the Queen's College asking for an elaborate dinner for two, each dish meticulously described. For instance, pheasant. Shooting had begun only the day before. Without bread, poultice, gravel or fried counters. And so on. But disliking to have undergraduates spend extravagantly, I got ready a very nice meal, though I winkled their oysters, so to speak, all the way through. Chicken, for instance, instead of gun-warm pheasant, and for aubergines, stuffed cucumber. They arrived, and weren't undergraduates at all, but as I learnt afterwards, T.W. Allen, Fellow of Queen's College, and Dr. Cowley, Curator of the Bodleian, the two undisputed reigning epicures of Oxford. Allen had at least his bottle of Chateau d'Yquem 1914, and Cowles his Chateau Lafitte 1907. After dinner, Allen said heavily, "We are a dining club. We've dined together for 25 years. Once we had a guest, but never again. This is the first time we've dined out of college, but we shall return." They never did. I couldn't tell them the reason why I'd economised. I was so sick about it all. Anyhow, Dr. Cowley at least got knighted later. A thin, wild-eyed young man came for the night. For supper, I gave him a huge helping of jugged hare, which he ravished in a few moments, so I gave him another. Hearing next morning that he'd gone out after breakfast to get a shave, and hadn't paid his bill, I put the horse into the old omnibus and galloped to the station. He wasn't there, and I never saw him again. But the fellow who drives beer about for me told me that he'd met the man at the pub that morning, and asked him to come and have a drink at the Spread Eagle. "No, thank you," was the reply. "I don't like their beer."
That was Malcolm Greaves reading another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. There'll be more from him next week. Good gracious, our hour is up already. You've been listening to Dialect Radio, courtesy of the Bristol Radio Co-op. You can download our shows at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Thank you to Ronaldo Marikeo. And he's asked us to point out that next year, in 2010, is the 200th anniversary of the setting up of the state of Chile and of Argentina. And of course, the Mapuches will be doing peaceful protests. So whilst the states will be celebrating, the Mapuches won't be. Thanks also to Josie Hill for coming into the studio. Features were by myself, Tony Gosling, and Anthea Page, who also provided tea and biscuits. John Peters Coleman provided the What's On guide, and engineering was by Vilas Chitrakaran. The producer of this week's show was John Peters Coleman. If you'd like to get involved in dialect, perhaps in presenting, engineering, or maybe you're not quite sure how, then just do it. Get in touch with Volunteering Bristol by visiting bristolvolunteers.org.uk or call 0117 989 7733. You don't need previous experience of radio and we're a friendly bunch, but if you're serious, a bit of commitment is necessary. Next week in the studio we have Sons of Sunday, live. Thanks then to all at BCFM on 93.2 FM, and with that, until next week, adieu.